You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight will be estate planning and special interests that emerge when assets or even children may cross international borders. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. My guests in the studio with me tonight are each certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, are certified specialists in the area of estate planning, trust, and probate law. Each have their LLM, that's their Master of Laws, in estate planning. Janet Brewer of Palo Alto. Janet recently completed her term as a member of the State Bar of California Board of Trustees. And Alicia Gamez of San Francisco. Alicia also has her LLM in taxation and is working to pass legislation to enable power of attorney for the care of a minor child. And we'll be discussing that at some length tonight. Both of my guests are members of the Trust and Estate section of the California Lawyers Association. Let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights. I want to start by inviting anyone who has an interest in probate, estate planning issues, or child issues, especially in light of recent events in the news, to call. Even if your questions are not limited to the area we're discussing, we will discuss the areas you call us with, so please feel free to call us. Even if it doesn't involve the very issue we're discussing at that moment, we're here to help. Again, the phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or again, if you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And with that, Janet, Alicia, let me welcome both of you.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with the overall question. You know, just what is it that we're talking about when we talk about planning for your child, plans that may cross over international borders? Would one of you like to start with that?
Well, when I think of crossing international borders, besides the obvious issue that is in the news today about childhood detention, I think about the issue of if something were to happen to a child's parents and they wanted their child to go back to the country that the parents came from. Let's assume that the parents have moved here from China or from France or the UK, and something happens to the parents and they want the child to go back to be with family members. How do you get them there? That would be one of the main issues that I get asked in my practice. How do we get our child home? What steps do we need to take? And what do we do until the family members get here to take care of that child?
And are there a lot of obstacles that you have to overcome?
There's some practical obstacles. First of all, there needs to be a formal court procedure. But even before we get into the formal court procedure, we've got the practical issues of if the child is in daycare, who's going to pick him up? If you want your sister who's in China to be able to take care of the child, to be the person that is going to become their guardian, how long is it going to take that person to get here? What's going to happen to the child before they get here? Do you have any kind of interim child care set up that will be recognized by the person who's taking care of them, by the school? And Alicia, this feeds, I think, right into the bill that you're working on right now to establish a procedure for those very things.
Well, before we get there, Alicia, let me ask you about what tools exist now that could help parents in the current scheme. What exists to help navigate through the current obstacles?
So currently, the way that a parent can set up, in effect, what's an emergency preparedness plan. If something should happen to the mom or the dad or both, you can, on the one hand, create an estate plan, which is something that you would ideally work with an attorney, and I would say necessarily work with an attorney to do. But if you have other concerns, one of the things you can do is you can go on to, for example, the Immigration Legal Resources Center, ILRC website, where there, and if you also just Google family preparedness plan, there will be a formula sort of put out by which it's basically like an organizer. It helps you assemble all of the information you need in one place of all of the contact people, the doctors, the teachers, the schools, the prescriptions that someone might need to know about in order to take care of your child. But the thing to know is that there are very few tools right now under California law for a parent to plan in a manner that will be legally recognized. The most fundamental or basic tool is, on the one hand, a family preparedness kit. It's not a legal document. It's an organizer. The next thing to know is that if you want someone else to be able to pick up your child from a school, you actually have to go in and, you know, fill out an emergency pickup card, a form at the school for that would authorize someone to release the child to that individual. Next step up is, in the event that something happens to you and your child ends up in the care of someone else, there is something called a child care affidavit. And an affidavit is a document in which someone swears something. And the person who is the person swearing is called the affiant. And that person is the one who finds himself in the care of a child. If you are in the care of a child and you need, for example, to enroll the child in school or get some very basic medical care for that child, there's a child care affidavit that you can sign. It's in the code. It's a statutory form. You can go online and Google child care affidavit, and you can find it in many places. Print it, and in that document, the person who ends up with the custody and control of that child, or actually it's just the care. It's not the legal custody. It's just the care of the child, would swear that I am a person who is in the care of this child. And with using that form, you can do very minimal things like enroll the child in school, authorize some very basic health care that's necessary in connection with school. If you are one of certain enumerated family members, you can also authorize a little bit more school care-related medical care. So that is the first sort of legally recognized document.
And when you talk about an organizer, you're talking about something similar to what you're tax preparer would give you at the end of the year.
Right. It's just sort of a list of things to guide you in terms of, you know, if you're asked the question, well, what do I need to organize and take care of my kid? What would a stranger need? It's just a document that is a form that just asks you a bunch of questions. They can be sometimes feel quite overwhelming because they can be very long. But don't let that get in your way. It's just an opportunity to pose one question after another to make sure that you have covered all your bases. But that's just the organizer. Next, you have the child care affidavit, which will generally be part of that organizer or referenced in that organizer. And the next step up, which unfortunately people get advised to do a lot currently, is to sign a guardianship nomination form. And so people use the term guardianship and guardian loosely. And one has to keep in mind that be careful about how you use words because just be aware that they have two meanings. A guardianship is, on the one hand, a term that you might say that I am the person taking care of a child. For example, last year I was a host to a foreign exchange student, and I was his guardian. But there was no formal legal proceeding there. His mother actually, in the foreign country, retained all legal rights as to that child. I was just the local guardian. There was no formal document that I ever engaged with him. However, there is a proceeding called a guardianship proceeding. The form that people have been advised to sign, which is a guardianship nomination form, when a child goes through a guardianship proceeding, that guardianship proceeding is typically and is suited for, designed for, a circumstance where a child is being removed from a home due to abuse or neglect. And that's really what a guardianship proceeding is about. And when a parent in a family preparedness kit prepares a nomination, a guardianship nomination, what they're doing is they're volunteering to have their parental rights severed in the same form and format as though they were themselves an abuser or someone who would be neglecting children or their own child. The problem there is that the process of creating a formal guardianship suspends a parent's rights, and they are very, very difficult to recover. In fact, last year I organized a panel regarding an emergency family preparedness with the view of preparing families for the current immigration crisis. I had clients who came to me with a concern, and in doing my research, realized that there's really not a good in between the child care affidavit and the guardianship, and so put together a panel.
We'll pause there for a moment, and Brenda from San Francisco, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I'm so sorry that the question that I'm going to ask you is not concerned with what you've just been talking about, but if you'll be willing to consider it, I would be really interested in finding out what the difference is between having a will and having a trust set up for when you die. I happen to be in my late 70s, and I do have a retirement account, and a small savings account. So, you know, depending on how long I live, which I hope isn't going to be forever, that will really affect how much I leave. And my understanding is that if you have a will, then that takes some time to be dealt with once you're no longer around, and of course it also might involve legal fees and so on. So the recipients or the beneficiaries of your will end up having to wait quite a while and probably not get as much as they thought they would. Whereas on the other hand, with a trust, unless you've got a heck of a lot of money, then is that a practical thing to do? I love your comments.
So, Brenda, thank you for your question. It seems to me you're really asking two questions. The first really has to do with the difference between a will and a trust and how they each pan out. And the second question that you really asked is, at what point does it make sense to use a trust as opposed to a will or vice versa? And if you would take your answer on the air, I will pass those questions, both of them, over to our guests.
I'm willing to take a crack at that. Brenda, actually, there's a third question that I think is buried there. You indicated that you have an IRA account, and it sounds to me like that may be your major asset because you said you had an IRA and a small savings account. If you have an IRA, you should have a beneficiary designated on that IRA. If you do not have a beneficiary designated, that is something that I would recommend that you do immediately. When you have accounts that have beneficiary designations on them, those designations take precedence over anything that you might have in either a will or a trust. Now, having said that, on to the next question, will versus trust. Both of those things are ways to distribute your property after you pass away, making sure that they go to the people that you want the property to go to. The trust is a little bit of a hybrid, I tell people, in that it also affects your property, or it also takes care of managing the use of your property when you're alive but incapacitated. A will does not take effect until the time that you pass away. As to whether you should use a will or a trust, cost certainly is an issue. As a general rule, it costs a little bit more to set a trust up on the front end than it does to do a will, but it costs a very lot less on the back end to administer. As you said, the will needs to go through a court proceeding. The legislature has said that if you have a lawyer helping you, or even if you have an executor helping you, there's a statutory fee that we're entitled to charge, whether it takes us 10 minutes, 10 hours, or 10,000 hours to handle the estate. It's a flat fee that gets charged. And it gets to be steep very, very quickly. Again, the trust is usually less expensive than the will. I don't know if that's...
So I will just add that I will second everything that Janet just said and say that one of the things to understand is that I always like to say, start with the word for probate, which is the section of law and the name of the court, and it's also a verb, derives from the word to prove, from the, it has the same Latin derivation. And that's important because what really you're doing at death is passing good legal title, proving legal title to your heirs. In probate, you can, or at death, you can pass things by contract, through a formal probate proceeding, which is what a will, what happens with a will. If you don't have a will or a trust, if you have nothing, you actually do have an estate plan. It's called the California Probate Code, and there is a formula there that will divvy up your assets among your heirs, heirs as defined by law. And then finally, you can do things through a trust or another contract. IRAs, retirement plans, life insurance all have policies and procedures associated with them, and you have to designate through their own method the beneficiaries. I really highly recommend that when you submit a beneficiary designation to your IRA or to your 401k or to your life insurance, that you not only send it in through some way that is verifiable, that you can prove that you sent it, but get a receipt back. Make sure that you go back after you've sent it in and that they have received it and gotten it on their books, because if you don't, I mean, and it happens, they don't recognize it, or they've lost it or somehow lost track of it, your heir, who hopefully understands that they're a beneficiary under that document, will need to be able to prove that they were there. And so one is, when you submit a beneficiary designation, do it, make sure, confirm, follow up. If your primary asset is a beneficiary, is an IRA or life insurance, then, and you don't have real estate and you don't have other complex assets, and I will add complex beneficiaries, then you might be able to get away with doing some joint account, you know, some joint tenancy types of accounts or pay on death accounts with beneficiary designations and get away with a pretty low-cost, self-directed planning. If, however, you have complex beneficiaries, meaning individuals who have special needs of some kind or creditor or dependency problems, then I really think that at that point you need to start thinking about a trust or a will that has a testamentary trust. Janet was correct in saying that a will will always have statutorily defined fees. Trusts are typically, attorneys will administer a trust, administering meaning get it to the beneficiaries at an hourly attorney rate. But I will tell you, as soon as someone starts fighting, and so I will say a trust is typically cheaper on the first pass than a will administration under probate court. But if anyone fights, that savings goes out the window and everything gets expensive.
Brenda, thank you for your question. Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. And again, to anybody listening, we're here to answer your questions. Even if it's not about the area we're discussing, feel free to call us with any estate planning, trust, probate issues. Our number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local calling area, our number here is 866-798-8255. And the last question brought up a related question I have. Janet, we've talked about children and about getting your children from one country to another. What about assets? What special issues arrive when you have assets that need to move from one place to another? Or maybe they exist in a jurisdiction other than where your trust or will are written?
Well, there are a number of issues, and I'm going to talk about them both in terms of assets that are in the United States but in a different state than California, and also talk about them in terms of assets that are either in another country or, again, you want to get them to someone who's in another country. Piggybacking a little bit on our last caller, I noticed that she had an accent. If her beneficiaries are located outside of the United States, even if the only asset that she has is an IRA, if she wants IRA assets to be distributed to someone in a different country, there's a practical issue that arises. They have to get something called an ITIN, an International Taxpayer Identification Number. The plan custodian is not going to let those assets out of the country unless there's a way to collect the taxes on them. And they need a beneficiary's taxpayer ID number in order to do that. So even in a relatively simple situation, if there's foreign recipients involved, it's not necessarily an easy problem. Now, dealing with assets, again, it depends on who are those assets going to on the other end, and frankly, how old are the beneficiaries, and as Alicia alluded to, are there any special issues with those beneficiaries? Are they children with special needs? Are they adults with special needs of any sort? Moving the assets outside of the country, again, is relatively simple. It may require getting an ITIN. Where it gets a little bit more complex is if you have a child who's, again, a U.S., let's say a U.S. citizen. Parents are not U.S. citizens, but they have a child that was born in the United States who is a U.S. citizen, and they want that child to go back to the home country. And there are significant assets that are involved. Probably if the child is under 18, they don't want to give the child direct access to the assets because legally they wouldn't be able to do anything with them. So they would need to set up some sort of a trust. Either they would set up a living trust that makes provisions for someone to manage the assets on behalf of the child, or they create what Alicia alluded to earlier, a testamentary trust, which is simply a trust established inside a will. In either event, they need to name someone to manage those assets. That person is a trustee. If they name someone who lives outside of the United States, even if that person is a U.S. citizen living outside of the United States, they have an immediate tax problem. They have created what's called a foreign trust, and there is a tax penalty for having a trust for a U.S. beneficiary that is not managed within the United States. So, there are a lot of issues that they need to think about.
Thank you. And with that, we'll turn to Omar in Oakland. You're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Good evening. Yes, I just have a question about 401ks and NIDA. What is the best way to pass that money to your heirs? I hear that the IRAs seem to have some advantages.
So I think I understood Omar to ask what is the best way to pass 401k or IRA assets to heirs, and really the best. There are a couple of ways, but the most direct way is if that individual does not have, you know, special needs of any kind, you can just make sure to fill out the beneficiary designation form. Typically, a beneficiary designation form will have the opportunity, a little form where you will name the individual's name, put a percentage interest that you want them to receive. You know, if maybe it's among three people and you want one to get half and the other two to get 25% each, whatever, adding up to 100. You can identify them, give them, name their social security numbers. Typically, you want to include that in the form, and then the percentages. Also, there will be typically a contingency if it doesn't pass with that individual in the first one, that you have a backup recipient. But again, when you institutions will have an opportunity for you to fill this out online, and you can log into your account and fill it out online. Or if they don't have that, print it, go to the institution, fill it out, and make sure you get a copy of it stamped received be able, make sure you go back and check your account afterwards and make sure that that your directions were acknowledged and received and documented in the account. Keep a copy of that and keep it with your important papers.
Omar, thank you for joining us.
Can I just clarify? My question was, what is it better to have an IRA? Because I can convert my 401k into an IRA just leave it as a 401k.
It's an ERISA question.
Advantage? Is there an advantage of one with respect to the other?
I understand, Omar. So thank you for clarifying that. What Omar is asking us is whether he's better to leave his 401k or to go through an IRA.
Frankly, it depends on some of the terms that are contained in the 401k agreement. There's a distinction between IRAs and 401ks in that a 401k actually operates by slightly different rules. Some of those rules involve whether or not the beneficiary can actually stretch out the distributions under the 401k, and if they are stretching those distributions out, whether they have any control over the investments at the time that they're doing that. In many cases, employers really don't want you to keep the 401k after you've terminated your status as an employee. So they will have provisions in the 401k plan documents that require you to take the remaining balance out, or require your beneficiaries to take the remaining balance out over a very short period of time. If you want the beneficiary to be able to take the money over a longer period of time, you really need to have moved it into an IRA. And as far as I know, and Alicia, you may know this better than I do, with a 401k, you can't really do a rollover. There is no provision, as far as I know, to roll it into any kind of an IRA after the account owner has passed away. You have to stick with the terms of the 401k plan of the employer. Now, I may be wrong. You may know more about that than I do.
Well, I think that the key thing here is that IRAs and 401ks, we as consumers seldom interface with what's called the plan document. And each 401k and each IRA actually is governed by a private contract called a plan document, and those plan documents have provisions that we seldom know about. 401ks are creatures of employers, and typically you're well suited to stay with a 401k plan while you're employed there and perhaps afterwards, but often they have more limited investment opportunities. One of the things that will motivate or encourage people to leave the 401k of their employer after they leave, if they leave the employment of that institution, is because an IRA might give you more opportunities to invest in a more diversified, or maybe diversified is the wrong word, just different assets, different mutual funds. 401ks are often very restricted by the employer. So is it better or worse? It's really hard to say. But the at death, I have seen, it's hard to say that it's flexibility. I've seen both flexibility and odd brittleness by plan sponsors. They often will. So one of the things that Janet alluded to is that under the tax code, there are typically a few different options. You can either take an inheritance outright in one lump sum. And remember, 401ks typically, and IRAs, traditional 401ks and IRAs, are income that you've deferred income taxation on. And so when you take them out at the other end, there will be income taxes due on them. This is as different than estate taxes. It's income taxes. That's not the case with a Roth IRA. Roth IRAs, the taxes are paid up front. But so if you have an income taxable Roth or 401k or IRA, and you take it as a lump sum, all of those taxes will be realized up front. Some will allow you to take it only over 5 years as opposed to a lump sum, and then some will let you stretch it out over the lifetime of the beneficiary. And so those are the factors to consider and to maybe look into on your own plan.
Omar, I hope that gave you a better answer to your question, and thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And again, welcome back. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. My guests in the studio with me tonight are Janet Brewer of Palo Alto. Janet has recently completed her term as a member of the State Bar of California Board of Trustees, and Alicia Gamez of San Francisco. Both of my guests are board certified specialists in the areas of estate planning, trust, and probate law. Both guests are members of the Trust and Estate section of the California Lawyers Association. And again, welcome to you both. If you have questions for my guests, our number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And Elaine from Berkeley is still on the line.
Yes, I am.
Thank you. You've been very patient. And welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Sure, thank you. My question has to do with my mom's house was recently sold in San Francisco, and the funds for the house are now in a what you call a trust account. And I just didn't understand the difference between a trust account and a regular bank account. Can you say something about that?
Is your mother living right now?
Yes.
And so, and she must have set up a revocable trust at some point in time, is that correct?
Yes.
So in general, if I've understood what you're saying, an individual who sets up a trust during their lifetime and while they have capacity, it's
yes.
like any other account. I mean, it's just they're holding their assets in a way that makes it hopefully easy to administer. I will suggest to you that while your mother is living and while she has capacity, to make sure that she has knowledge of where her documents are, so that if she passes, you'll be able to get those documents and efficiently administer. But while she's alive, it's kind of a tax. What we call it's this is actually a technical term, a tax nothing. While she's alive, because it everything from her trust account reports straight through to her on her income taxes. It's not a limitation. However, if she loses capacity, you'll want to look at her trust document and see who she has designated as a successor trustee, because that person then would be able to come in with that trust document, go into the bank, go to a lawyer, get do some paperwork, which is by which mom will designate that you would file at the county typically a notice of change of trustee. So that there is on notice that the assets are now being managed by someone else. But you would be able to fairly seamlessly step in and begin running things for your mother and for her sole interests, unless she's said differently in her account, in her trust.
Someone just told me that when funds are in a trust, that no one can just, like, bill collectors can't come and just take the money out.
No, that's false.
False?
No one can actually just come and take money out in the first place. There would have to be a judgment. But as long as your mother is alive and the trust is what we call revocable, which means that she can terminate the trust at any point she chooses, under California law, having a trust provides no protection against creditors making a claim against that that money. There are, in certain circumstances, irrevocable trusts, trusts that one cannot terminate by will. Excuse me, when I say by will, I mean by willingness to do so as opposed to the formal legal document we call a will. But you can't just, if it's an irrevocable trust, certain conditions must be met before it can be terminated. Depending upon the terms of the irrevocable trusts, and frankly, depending upon the jurisdiction in which those trusts were created, there may be asset protection, but an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, everyday, revocable trust provides no asset protection. This is a scenario that I'm asked about frequently. There's a lot of misinformation on the internet about the ability to reach the assets that are held in a living trust or in a revocable trust.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's called a self-settled trust. If you set up a trust for your own benefit, you do not get to hide your assets from creditors in California. That is different in places like Nevada.
Or Alaska
or Wyoming. You can do that for yourself. They are very expensive, and so it's not for the run-of-the-mill individual. And if the assets are in California and you are a resident of California, I'm skeptical about whether a court will truly shield those assets. They are best suited for liquid assets in another jurisdiction. But getting back to your point, a creditor doesn't have direct access to your bank account anyway. It would have to be after a series of legal procedures. For your mother, while she has capacity, her creditors will have access. I mean, she will be vulnerable to creditors. She can't go out and charge up a credit card and then decide not to pay it and think that her assets will be shielded. However, the next point is, if her revocable trust becomes irrevocable, if she passes away, and if her trust has provisions in it, it can have creditor protections for her heirs and beneficiaries. And so if she plans in advance, and if this is one of the reasons I said to a prior caller, it depends on whether your heir has issues or has complexity. If you have someone, a child or someone who's dependent on you and who has creditor issues, you want to plan for that and provide that there are spendthrift provisions and that are properly established. Because in California, there have been fairly recent court cases that say the point is that there are opportunities for the heirs of someone who has a trust to protect assets from being taken by creditors on that person's death. You cannot set one up for your own benefit, however, and expect to escape creditors.
Okay, well, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Thank you for joining us here on Your Legal Rights. And again, if you're listening, you are listening to Your Legal Rights, KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. And I'd like to invite anybody who is interested in probate and estate issues or the other issues we're going to be talking about to feel free to call us here in the studio. Even if your issue is not the same as the one we're discussing at the moment, feel welcome to call. Our number here is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside the area, feel free to call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. We were talking a while ago about dealing with children, getting them from one place to another, or perhaps dealing with children across international borders. And I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the current situation, what's happening with children that have been separated from their parents and held in detention. Tell us a little bit how this relates and what we can do to avoid such problems, or what we can do to help those that are there.
Well, one of the things, of course, that a parent can do is go to, if they're an immigrant parent themselves or otherwise, go to one of the websites, like Google Child Preparedness or Family Preparedness Kit. Go through that inventory of information that you need to prepare. But set up an estate plan or a will that will designate a guardian if something, if you die. But right now in California, there's no document or no legally recognized tool for a parent to provide legally recognized instructions that will respect and maintain the parent's rights as a parent and provide simultaneous continuous care for their child. So it's actually, we have a bit of a gap in the law. The drama of what we're seeing, and it's a terrible drama of what we're seeing with children being separated from their parents, is, I don't know even really what to how to say it. It's a government of well, we've got Death Eaters running in that regard. But
not all of us have read the Harry Potter books and are familiar with the phrase, but most all of our listeners over the last few days have seen horrific pictures or heard horrific recordings of children that are in obvious distress, young as those that are still being breastfed, who have been separated from the parents and are basically held in detention camps throughout the country. The word today was that Bill Blasio learned of a detention center in New York City that he did not theretofore know existed and had some 240 children in it and had yet to gain access. It's a growing problem. Is there anything that could have been done to avoid this?
If there were a circumstance where a parent is in California and is detained in California, really the only things that they have available to them are the child care affidavit, a family preparedness plan, and some people counsel parents in this circumstance to fill out a guardianship nomination form. I personally would only suggest that a parent fill that out after they fully understand the consequences of it, because a guardianship nomination form is a parent what a parent does in signing that is basically they volunteer to have their parental rights suspended so that someone else can take care of their child for a period of time. And those, it's an unfortunate circumstance. There's a real gap in law right now, and I've experienced it with my own clients in trying to plan for them. And what I will typically do is engage in a very in-depth interview with them in which we and put together basically a binder of information. It's not a legal binder, but it's a user-friendly binder that helps them just be prepared in the event something happens.
Yeah, and Jeff, to your point, in terms of the detention centers, quite frankly, I don't know that even having the documents that Alicia is discussing would help in that circumstance. These are people that are coming into the United States. They most likely did not create any types of forms ahead of time to provide for the care of their children in the event that they were detained at the border. And even if they did, we're dealing with federal law, and I don't know that federal law would be required in those kinds of circumstances to follow state law. This gets into the issue of, no pun intended, which law trumps which. Is federal law, does federal law pertain, or would state law pertain in a case like this?
Unfortunately, we don't have the high hat after the Trump remark, but we can turn it over to Ed in Menlo Park. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. My mother is quite elderly. She's going to be turning 88 in a few weeks, and her Medi-Cal eligibility is in process in Los Angeles, where she resides, which is where I grew up. And I'm wondering if any estate planning with regard to a trust should wait until that matter is fully resolved before drawing up a trust, because it has various impacts. If it matters, I happen to be a blind individual, but I do own my own home here in the Bay Area. I don't know what factors may be important with respect to that, if any.
Well, let me ask a question. Does your mother own real estate?
Yes, she does. That is really her only major asset, is her home. Her She does have a small account at a financial institution. It's small, as you know, since she's being considered for Medi-Cal. As you know, her resources would have to be quite minimal in that respect.
Right. So the actually, in the last few years, there's been a change in law that in which if I'm remembering this correctly, and I will have to check myself as well, but the backing up, Medi-Cal, if you rely on Medi-Cal to for your needs at end of life or at other times, there is effectively a lien placed on your estate. They will not recover it currently, but after you die, it's part of a Medi-Cal recoverable estate. And so one of the things that can be recoverable is against the proceeds of a sale of a home or against a home. Recently, that code has been changed to redefine what the recoverable estate is. And my understanding is that it's only recoverable against a probate estate, and that code was changed, I don't know, in the last two years, I think. And so actually, I think, and I don't, it may be that the timing will be important. So, go ahead, Janet.
Well, there was one other, I do not practice in the area of Medi-Cal. Frankly, when I get Medi-Cal questions, I refer them to another attorney. But you said one thing that is very important in this whole discussion, and that is that you are blind. My recollection of Medi-Cal law is that if your mother is on Medi-Cal and the house, for example, passes to you at the time of her death, because you are assuming that you became blind prior, I think that the law is that if you became incapacitated, disabled, blind, prior to reaching age 18, that you can actually defer the collection of the Medi-Cal lien as well. I do not know if that requires that your mother have the asset in a trust, or if you can also defer the application of that lien if the house were to go through probate. But I would encourage you to talk to a Medi-Cal specialist about that issue. I think you may qualify. That may be an exception to the Medi-Cal recovery rules. I don't know for a fact.
So what I would suggest is that you look into whether a current, how to put it, oftentimes there's a look-back period for when you transfer an asset in Medi-Cal planning and Medicaid planning. And so I would encourage you to research the question of whether a contemporaneous transfer will be respected in order to shield the proceeds of a home from a Medi-Cal recovery. And that's, and without further research, I'm reluctant to say more.
I see. So, but she's not on Medi-Cal yet. I don't know if she'll be eligible or not. And the only context she would ever use Medi-Cal would be if she needed senior care at a facility of that type. Assisted living, but actually beyond that, whatever you call that stage when you can't take care of yourself on your own. In other words, you need a nursing home, I suppose. Is that the proper term? I don't know if that's considered the proper term.
Sure.
And so that would be really the only context, I think, that she would utilize it primarily. Although, of course, if she became eligible for Medi-Cal, I guess this means that she will be getting medical benefits in that way, and I don't know if those also are recoverable.
I just checked something, and it does say that now, by the way, an estate subject to Medi-Cal recovery is a technical term, and it is a probate estate. Mm-hmm. And so now the next question is just in regards. And so I don't know if you recall, but earlier in the program I described there are a few different ways of passing assets at death. One of the ways is through beneficiary designations. Another way is a trust. And another way is through a formal court proceeding called probate.
We should avoid probate, right? That's my understanding. Yeah.
A probate estate is a technical term. and it is assets mm-hmm. that pass through that probate administration. So IRA assets, beneficiary designations, those are not part of the probate estate. It's a technical term. Okay. And if the home ends up in the probate estate, it will be part of the recoverable assets for Medi-Cal.
Oh. So
could he avoid that by having the home?
Can I be declared as a beneficiary?
Could that be avoided by putting the home in joint tenancy?
Well, I would suggest rather there's a relatively new tool under California law called a
revocable trust deed or a revocable.
There's a pay on it's a transfer on death.
Transfer on death deed. That's it.
It's a transfer on death deed. It's a little bit complicated, but it's very low cost in general as opposed to a full blown trust. You can so in other words, there are very many ways to get things out of the probate estate. You can do it by contract, for example, a transfer on death deed. You can do it through a trust by creating a trust and deeding it into a trust. But in all mm-hmm. of these things, and Jeff mentioned a joint tenancy, but again, a joint tenancy is a current gift of a one-half interest, and so it could be it could cause other tax problems.
That would have a large effect. She's owned her home for many years, and thus there would be a I guess that federal tax, what do you call it, the increased value. Now, if I become an owner all of a sudden, don't I have to pay that large sum of money on the gain in the property?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So that's a very important point. If an individual receives an asset as a gift during life, you get the basis, mm-hmm. the tax basis, income tax basis of the person who gifted it to you. However, if you receive it as a gift as a result of that individual's death, you get a full step up in basis of the fair market value as of the date of that person's death. And so it is a very taxpayer-friendly avenue that allows beneficiaries to, one, have a knowable basis, because it's very difficult to understand what the original basis was. And if you can't mm-hmm. prove it, you get a zero basis. But if you get it as a gift, you can get an appraisal done as of the date of the death, and then any subsequent sale, you'll have capital gains only measured from the date of the death to the capital gains or loss to the sale value.
Ed, I hope that helps you out, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Ken from Berkeley, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Oh, hi. I have a sort of a detailed question about the beneficiaries of a 401k, because my situation is I have both an IRA and a 401k, and I'm retired, and I'm not drawing on them yet. And originally, the beneficiaries to both were my wife, but unfortunately, she died before me. But she had two kids, and I want to make my stepchildren the beneficiaries. And on the IRA, it was pretty straightforward, because I could put them in as primary beneficiaries, and there was a box to check that said per stirpes, which I understand means that if they die, it goes to their descendants. But on the 401k, which is from my employer, they just have a box that says primary beneficiaries and a box that says contingent beneficiaries. So my question is, would it be valid for me to put each of the stepchildren in as a primary beneficiary with a note per stirpes attached to it, or do I have to go through and list all their children as contingents?
You should be able to. So even though you're only given one line or two lines on one of those forms to provide the names of the beneficiaries and how you want it distributed, you do have the right to create a longer form that would give more of an explanation as to who gets it. But I would suggest that you...
At my old job, she actually suggested attaching a copy of the form from my IRA to show what I wanted, but I thought that sounded a little iffy.
Well, the problem that I see with attachments is that they get separated from the document and they can't be found when they're needed. I think you should be able to put, you know, stepchildren, John Smith, Mary Smith, by right of representation, or the legal acronym for that sometimes is by ROR, and which is the equivalent of per stirpes. Some technical differences, but they don't really matter. But make it squeeze it on there, make it fit.
And one of the things you should do is inquire with the institution, because, again, these are governed by what are called plan documents. There is a – it's probably a 50-page long document with all kinds of detail. And that should be – you should be able to inquire with your administrator to say, I want to do this. Help me. And get it done.
Or, quite frankly, do an IRA rollover. Take it out of your employer's plan and put it into the same IRA that you have your other IRA in.
Ken, thank you for joining us. I hope this was of some help to you. And thank you for listening to Your Legal Rights. Our last call of the night, we're down to the last couple minutes. Our last call will be also from Berkeley. John, you're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question about, I'm the second successor trustee on an irrevocable trust that I just recently took over. And as a result of coming on, the insurance company, when I noticed them that I was the current trustee, sent a notice of cancellation of the homeowner's policy. And the broker handling it sent me a new policy that basically doubled the cost of the insurance with no particular change in the policy.
Well, let me ask you, let me interject real quick. Is the individual, the irrevocable trust, is the beneficiary of that trust?
Well, is the person who set it up, I think you mean.
Is the person who set it up still living?
No.
And is the home in question occupied?
It's occupied by her husband.
So I think that really, so what this generally means is that your homeowner's that homeowner's insurance is assuming that the house is vacant. And the risks to a house that is vacant are far higher, and insurance policies go up. And for that reason, they assume that what they've got is a decedent's home and the home is vacant. And they want to be properly indemnified for that, and they want to set the premium correctly. What you need to do is just contact the broker and just say, it's not vacant. It's occupied. It's just just clarify that with them. I bet that's going to get you 90% of the way there.
And if it doesn't, no,
I did wrote a letter, and nothing happened.
Well, in that case,
said it had to happen.
In that case, I might suggest that you might want to, as they say, shop the policy. I'm sure that the homeowners company the insurance company that you're dealing with is not the only company that offers homeowners insurance. Check out a couple of different companies and see if they will offer a better price on the policy.
John, thank you for joining us, but we are out of time. Thank you, John. I hope this was of some help. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights right here on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I wanted to give each of you just a moment to sum up if there's something you wanted to add before we close. We have about a minute.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be on the show with you, Jeff, and lovely to see Janet again. And I look forward to being back on sometime to talk about these important issues.
And I would agree with Alicia. I want to bring up one thing that I try to talk to people about at this time of year. Many of you have children or grandchildren or friends of who have children who are turning 18. You should be aware that when those children turn 18, you no longer have the right to make any kind of legal decisions for them. You no longer have the right to make any medical decisions for them. Right to talk to their doctors. You need to get a plan in place for those 18-year-olds.
Thank you. My guests tonight have been Janet Brewer of Palo Alto and Alicia Gomez of San Francisco. Both of my guests are certified specialists in the area of trust and estates from the California Board of Legal Specialization. Each are members of the State Bar of the California Lawyers Association. Thank you both for joining us. Next week, we will again present our Call a Lawyer program operating here at KALW. My thanks to you for listening and to our production assistant, Martin McLean. At the controls, as always, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.